For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. One of the silver linings of the COVID-19 pandemic, if such a thing is possible, is that the public health policies and restrictions brought in to curb the spread of COVID have also knocked other infectious diseases on the head. Influenza is one, and there has also been a decline in the incidence of invasive meningococcal disease. With many experts predicting a nasty flu season this winter as restrictions lift and borders open, what can we expect for IMD?
A heightened level of suspicion is very important, particularly as we move into the winter months.
That was the voice of Professor Monica Lara, Medical Director of Microbiology with New South Wales Health Pathology at the Prince of Wales Hospital. She and her colleague Rob George, a microbiologist and pathologist with New South Wales Health at John Hunter Hospital, along with other colleagues, have written a perspective for the MJA on this subject. Monica and Rob are my special guests today. Thank you both for your time. You and other colleagues have written a perspective for the MJA about the decline in influenza and in invasive meningococcal disease during the COVID-19 pandemic. What do those three conditions have in common?
Thanks, Kate. So it's a good question to start with, because it's not just what they have in common, but it's also what sets them apart too. Influenza and COVID-19, I mean, they're viral infections caused by RNA viruses, and IMD or invasive meningococcal disease, that on the other hand is caused by a bacterial infection, Neisseria meningitidis, and people often get that confused. They do have a number of things that are in common. I mean, they're vaccine preventable. They have seasonal prevalence patterns. I mean, we're still learning a lot more about SARS-CoV-2. And they're transmitted by the respiratory route. This can be through direct, indirect, or close contact with infected people. Contact and droplet transmission is particularly important. In fact, probably meningococcal is probably sometimes transmitted in larger droplets, whereas we sometimes hear about the other two in smaller droplets, or even in, if the situation is right, in aerosolized particles. But the key thing is that all have the ability to kill or cause significant morbidity, and this can place considerable strain on the health system through hospitalizations, etc. I think another thing also to remember is that the mechanism of infection is probably slightly different with influenza and SARS-CoV-2. We often think of these as agents that infect rather than colonize per se, and so they infect the upper and potentially lower respiratory tract and causing infection. Whereas meningococcus, on the other hand, it can actually be a resident colonist. So that means that they can actually live in the human host without causing active infection. But there are these forms, and you might hear it's talking about it just a little bit more today. We talk about these groups. So these are encapsulated organisms, and there are certain types. There's group A, B, C, W, Y, for example. And these have got an enhanced ability to penetrate and cause invasive disease. And I guess one of the things to think about is exactly how that happens. And so bacteria, in fact, they're a bit larger than viruses, and that they have all these different mechanisms. And meningococcal bacteria, for example, they've got a real armory of processes. So they've got these things, without getting too technical. They've got pili, they've got lipo-oligosaccharides. They go through this process of twitching motility. And so basically they use all these things to try and to get into the host and potentially cause disease. So the pili, they're like little leg-like extensions that go through the capsule, and they provide the starting point to attachment to the epithelial cells for binding. The twitching motility allows them to form microcolonies and potentially move, and that polysaccharide capsule, it allows them to evade the host immune response. And once they get in, they can spread to the bloodstream, the central nervous system, and elsewhere. And, you know, they trigger an overwhelming, potentially a systemic inflammatory cascade into multi-organ failure and potentially death.
If they can colonise and not have an effect on the host for some time, what triggers them then having an effect?
I think you can break that down into two parts. Number one, it's to do with the organism, and number two, it's to do with the host. If it's an organism that happens to have the appropriate virulence factors, for example, it is one of these encapsulated forms, and it happens to find a host that for whatever reason is particularly susceptible. Maybe they've not been vaccinated. Perhaps they've had something else that has disrupted their epithelial lining, or potentially they're immunosuppressed. And they then, of course, the possibility is that they can then proceed forth and cause pretty nasty disease.
perhaps we need to talk about what the case numbers have been like both before and after the COVID pandemic for IMD and perhaps influenza, if you have those numbers available, or before and during.
To think about the case numbers, you know, once we saw the interventions come into place, we saw very quickly the IMD case numbers were impacted. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm going to use as a reference point March 2020, because that was a period, I don't know if you remember, there was Black Monday. And then, of course, it wasn't much longer after that, Australia closed its borders to non-citizens and non-residents 20th of March. And this 14-day period of self-isolation for travellers came in and all that. So it's a very sort of fixed point in time. Those first 3 months, in January 2020, there were 12 cases of IMD in Australia, or invasive meningococcal disease. February, there were 13 cases. And then in March, there were 6 cases. And on average, after that, for every other month, when you look at the other months for 2020, there were less than 7 cases per month. These very low rates continued into 2021, with just 18 between January and March for 2021, the equivalent period. And that's substantially lower than, for example, in 2017, when there were 72 cases for that same period. 2018, there were 52 cases. And then 2019, there were 38 cases. I guess another take-home thing to think about is the predominant serogroup has remained men B, which from 2019 has constituted half of the cases that were able to be grouped. But also you're talking about case numbers there. And I think the other thing that's really interesting is like the changing rate of influenza. So in 2019, before the pandemic, there were over 300,000 cases nationwide. In 2020, this fell to just 21,000 cases. But what's remarkable is that 95% of these were in that first 3 months that I was just referring to before the restrictions came into place. And those low numbers have continued into 2021 with far fewer than 1,000 cases recorded nationwide.
Is it fair enough to say that the public health policies and restrictions that were brought into play to prevent the spread of COVID, is there a causal relationship between those restrictions and the decline in IMD?
One can certainly note that there is a correlation between the two, and that one can map out the processes and how they would disrupt the transmission cycles, which would provide a mechanistic pathway through which those particular restrictions or actions could potentially have reduced IMD.
In your article, you talk about the interplay between flu and IMD. Can you explain that a little more?
I was previously talking a little bit about the pathogenesis of SARS-CoV-2 influenza and in particular meningococcus. And I guess where meningococcus can invade on its own, it is increasingly believed that a preceding infection by influenza could facilitate or facilitates invasion. And so it's likely that nasopharyngeal injury with influenza secondary to neuraminidase or immune dysfunction can allow these already colonizing meningococcal strains to invade, and this can then cause this fulminant disease. So that sort of provides a pathway through which it could occur. And in addition, things like, say, influenza could affect transmission by facilitating dispersion of the bacteria through coughing or sneezing. It's certainly this relationship holds true with influenza A, but perhaps less so with the less pathogenic influenza B or other respiratory infective agents such as RSV. What's particularly notable is that in Australia, we've seen that between 2006 and 2021, when there was a spike of IMD, it's been correlated with a concurrent spike in influenza cases very frequently. So the correlation shows that in 33 of the 36 statistically detectable IMD case count spikes at 6 standard deviations above the baseline, they've occurred during a period when there was also spike activity in influenza. And that really sort of maps out that interplay. The other interesting thing about that is when there were no influenza spikes during COVID, there were also no IMD spikes either.
Is there any overseas evidence as well as here in Australia?
In terms of public health policies and restrictions on the incidence of meningococcal disease, some more broad comments, Kate, would be that Neisseria meningitis is the leading cause of meningitis and bacteremia globally, And invasive infection occurs in two age groups, most commonly in infants and young children, and in a second peak's observed in adolescents and young adults. And overall, in some regions recently, there's been a decrease in incidence of IMD pre-COVID. But because of the high fatality rates of this infection and because of the risk of transmission to contacts and potential then for transmission of infection, it remains an infection of continuing public health importance. In general, the disease epidemiology is highly variable depending on the region. So in countries such as Australia, we have sporadic infections, but there can also be some clusters or outbreaks, whereas in other settings such as Sub-Saharan Africa, there's large epidemics that occur periodically. And we have a good understanding of the disease in this country because Australia has invested for decades in continuous surveillance of this disease. And so what we've observed is really the current status of the epidemiology. It's a sort of a real-time observation. And the public health policies and the restrictions from COVID, such as mask wearing and physical distancing and hand washing, were all put in place to interrupt transmission of infection. And the key findings then for us here were that the rates in Australia and elsewhere reported at historic lows, probably because of a combination of the vaccination targeted strategies that we have in place, because of the coincident low rates of influenza and the public health measures that we have that we've mentioned. So with regards to the overseas evidence about influenza and invasive meningococcal disease, or IMD, this association has been recognised for a long time and as far back as 1918, but it was recognised and established in a paper published by the British Medical Journal, which outlined prevention strategies for meningitis in military barracks. They were describing the role of antecedent influenza. And as Rob has mentioned as well in the sort of opening comments, that there's co-seasonality of respiratory viruses, including influenza and invasive meningococcal disease. So they both occur in wintertime or late winter, early spring in temperate countries. And so this does raise the question, are these infections co-seasonal or are they co-related? And In recent studies from North America, from Europe, and using Australian data, have found that surges in influenza activity result in an acute increase in population IMD when you control for predictable co-seasonality. So statistically, you can see that there is the associated risk is there when you control for those factors. And so what we've reported in this study, which has been reported elsewhere as well, there's a correlation of disease spikes of IMD influenza that's pronounced and statistically significant.
I'm speaking with Professor Monica Lara and Dr. Rob George from New South Wales Health about invasive meningococcal disease and what we can expect from it in coming months. Their co-authored perspective is available at mja.com.au, where it is open access. Did you know that if you listen to podcasts, it indicates that you have higher informational needs, lower belonging needs, and lower neuroticism than people who don't tune in to podcasts? That's according to research out of QUT, published this week in PLOS One. So, to improve yourself in so many ways, you can subscribe to our podcast via Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, and iHeartRadio. And you can catch up on previous episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. Back to our chat. Do any other infectious diseases show a similar correlation?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. So, look, in fact, the associations that play out between flu and IMD don't seem to be similarly correlated for other pathogens. To start with, for example, there's less evidence of interplay, as I think I already sort of have half alluded to, with SARS-CoV-2 and IMD. I mean, we've not seen surges in cases of IMD during concurrent surges in cases of SARS-CoV-2, for example, such as during these periods of Delta and Omicron case count surges. Meanwhile, during the pandemic, the impact of measures aiming to limit crowding and which have prevented person-to-person transmission of COVID have also appeared to impact a vast array of other infections. For example, pertussis transmission that substantially impacted 2021. And there are around 560 cases of pertussis, which is substantially lower than the five-year rolling average from 2016, which exceeded 12,000. And similarly, there have been declines in invasive pneumococcal disease seen in different parts of the globe. In Australia, numbers in 2021 were around 1,300, again lower than that 1,800 rolling five-year average. But RSV in the literature has been reported that there was a shift in disease peak in Australia from autumn and winter in 2020 to summer, with a decrease in hospitalizations and ICU admissions. And then other viruses, we've also seen declines. So chickenpox being caused by varicella zoster, 1966 cases in 2021 versus 3,600 or thereabouts, with the rolling five-year average. Measles, to my knowledge, no cases in 2021, 118 seen in the five-year average, and rubella, two cases in 2021 with a five-year average of 12, to my understanding or knowledge. And the thing to remember is that these five-year totals I'm just talking about there are also depressed because they contain 9 months in 2020 when interventions were already in play.
Monica said earlier that meningococcal disease has been under surveillance in Australia for a long time and there are vaccine programs and rollouts available. Were the numbers on the decline even before COVID turned up?
Yes, there were. So as mentioned, and for context, there are four main groups of meningococci causing disease in Australia, and these are groups B, C, W and Y. And according to the national records, meningococcal notifications in Australia peaked in 2002 at more than 680 cases that year, with most cases at that time were caused by group B and group C. And then in response in 2003, the meningococcal C vaccine was added to the national immunisation program. And by 2013, there was a greater than 80% decrease in meningococcal infections overall. However, after 2013, increased infections began to be observed again, and this was due in part to an increase in group W and to a lesser extent group Y disease. And in particular, the serogroup W disease was caused by a highly virulent strain that was causing infections and outbreaks overseas as well. Mm-hmm. By 2017, further changes to the schedule to replace the group C vaccine with a vaccine that covers groups A, C, W and Y resulted in declining disease rates from 2017. And by 2019, pre-pandemic, the notifications were low, but they were not lower than that reported in 2013, 10 years after the introduction of the MenC monovalent vaccine. But as we've reported in this paper, in 20 and 21, the meningococcal infection rates were the lowest ever reported in this country. And important to add that this is a notifiable disease, so all cases are reported, so have a fairly robust system for notifications of disease. We know what the numbers are.
Given the improvement of vaccines and the groups they cover and the decline before COVID, are you optimistic that that decline will continue even though restrictions are lifting?
That's a very good question. So we are in early days here, but a recent paper from the United Kingdom Health Security Agency reported that since restrictions were eased there in the UK in July 2021, there's been an increase in group B meningococcal disease in adolescents and young adults, particularly students. These UK data suggest that following the lifting of restrictions, disease rates may be held low by targeted vaccination strategies, but where immunity is low due to lack of immunisation or lack of exposure and transmission is high, as it's known to be in adolescents and young adults due to social interactions, disease rates may return to pre-pandemic levels. But for Australia, we expect that there'll be changes in infectious diseases epidemiology as restrictions ease, and we know what factors are important in infectious disease transmission and control, so we continue to observe closely in real time.
There's clearly been a raised awareness amongst the public about infection control and how to put brakes on that, you know, social distancing, masks, hand washing, etc. Do you think that will translate into lower numbers overall? In other words, I'm saying, will people learn the lesson and continue to perhaps, in the absence of public health restrictions, continue those behaviours themselves? Has the general public learned that there are other benefits besides not catching COVID?
As a general comment, raising awareness of infection control amongst the public has been a critical part of pandemic management, and practices such as hand hygiene, physical distancing, mask wearing, which are standard practices in hospitals, were amongst those implemented broadly in the general population to reduce transmission of infection. But this was a novel situation. Yeah. And as a result, you're right, there was a raised awareness of infection control principles in the general public. And the corollary of this, as we're measuring now, has been the reduction of transmissible diseases in Australia, as Robert has outlined, and in other countries as well, including meningococcal disease and influenza. But what happens going forward, it's difficult to say. We don't know.
Yes, how it will play out moving forward is anyone's best guess, but it's clear that there are benefits in certain circumstances to doing that.
Are you expecting a change in the serogroups that will be dominant? Are you expecting anything new to show up?
Both are possible. So we can have, as we saw with MenW or meningococcal serogroup W, that this emergence of a new group can come into the population and contribute to a significant proportion of disease. There are global surveillance, but there are gaps in those data as well. So we can look at what's happening in countries where there's investment and the surveillance data are available to have a look. And the immunisation strategies that we have here cover for the four serogroups plus or minus the meningococcal B. So it's difficult to predict, but there are others. There are more than those four groups that circulate and that cause infections elsewhere.
A lot of our listeners are GPs. Is there something in this for GPs in terms of what they should be looking out for, what level of suspicion they should have when it comes to meningococcal disease in the coming months?
A heightened level of suspicion is very important, particularly as we move into the winter months.
My thanks to my special guests today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.